God being a tripart being, and where one part of the triad starts and the other one stops, and how when Jesus became conscious of his oneness with God, all those things. And the Bible says what? Great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh, right? So look, you're not supposed to be able to figure it all out. Now, I don't know where you're at, but I mean, I can get a little obsessive with some things in my mind sometimes too, but the Bible clearly testifies there's a Godhead, a three-part Godhead, that Christ is God, that the Holy Spirit is God. And I hate to tell you this, but somebody in good faith, you just don't have to struggle with it. There's no need for you to have to figure out when Christ became fully conscious of his Godhood, whether at 3 years old or prior to his 12th birthday or something like that. You don't have to do that. Just know that God manifest in the flesh is a great mystery. It didn't say it was a great mystery. Great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh. And so these guys are fussing about things that they ought to be able to accept. And what you find out is that it's usually just heretics on both sides kind of going at each other. And so that's what happened here. Now, I'm not taking you deep into the weeds on this because it just gets long and drawn out. But just so you know, I'm not lying to you when I say that it's still an issue today. Here we are in 2026. It's always been an issue of people arguing about the nature of the Trinity. Okay, monarchianism up there at the top, they argued that Jesus became Christ at his baptism. And it's called adoptionism also because the Father then adopted him after his death. So you see what's happening. The stupid Gnostic philosophers are still trying to combine Bible with philosophy. And I'm telling you, it doesn't work. Subordinationism is the idea that the Trinity was God in three modes. So it's also called modalism. God's not a Trinity. He just has three modes. And it's also called subordinationism. I got confused. Christ is a God, not God. He is subordinate to the Father. Sabellianism is the Trinity was God in three modes. It's called modalism, therefore, and when it gets down to it, it was the Father that died on the cross. So it's passionism. Passion, the passion where he was crucified, and patri, the Father was crucified, not the Son. Exactly. Wow. Where do you get that? Not from the Bible at all. Macedonianism. That is, the Holy Spirit is a created being. It's also called pneumatomachism. Like I said, learn some new words. They're useless, but you learn new words. Apollinarianism. Christ had no human spirit. He was therefore only two-thirds human. Nestorianism. We'll meet him a little bit later. It's a good chance that he was misrepresented and slandered. But it came to mean anyway that Christ is a God-bearing man rather than a man who was fully God. We'll talk about him in just a minute, just in brief. I'm not taking you to the weeds on this. Just giving you an idea of the useless nonsense that men have argued over. They called councils and anathematized each other and condemned each other about this. And this is mainly just heathen people that call themselves Christians that damned each other, and it means nothing. Eutychianism by a guy named Eutyches. The human nature of Christ was totally absorbed by the Logos. Monophysitism, Christ only had one nature. Monothelitism is that Christ only had one will. Not my will, but thine be done, he said, so he only had one. Yeah. And we'll talk about Pelagianism here in a second. But, again, I'm not taking you to the weeds on this, but I wanted to give just tell you a couple of brief stories to give you an idea of just how useless this all was and just how nursery-ish it is. You have a bunch of grown men that are going at each other like a couple of stinking kids in diapers. For instance, okay, Apollinarianism, we told you about that a second ago, just in brief. That was started by a guy named Apollinaris, you might have guessed that. He tried to synchronize Christ's humanity and deity. And so he said Christ's body and soul was human, but his spirit was divine. So again, he makes Christ only two-thirds human. So the Council of Constantinople, now 381, I put some of these councils on the board for you last time and ran through them too. I'm not trying to take you into the weeds on that. But the Council of Constantinople condemned his heresy, but solved nothing. And so now everybody's arguing about the nature of Christ still. So Nestorianism, you see that a little more than midway down. There's a story behind it, and I want you to just know a little bit about the soap opera and the silliness of it. Nestorius was a monk. He is the patriarch also of Constantinople, so he is a monk in Constantinople. This is Asia Minor here. Of course, Israel's down here, Asia Minor. Constantinople's up here. And so he's a monk and the bishop of Constantinople. And there's this rivalry, of course, between Antiochian Christianity. Antioch of Syria is here, where the Christians were first called Christians, right? Alexandria is down here, where Origen and all those guys were. Well, it turns out that Nestorius fell to the Antiochian side. And again, don't think I'm trying to take you to the weeds on this, but there's this rivalry between Alexandria and Antiochian theology, okay, about Christ's nature. In Alexandria, they believed that Christ's natures, his two natures, were fused together in one inseparable union. In Antioch, they believed that Christ had two separate natures. And that's true, right? Now, also entangled in this is the fact that in Alexandria, they venerated Mary. And they were the ones that were trying to say that Mary, Jesus' mother, was the God-bearer. She was the mother of God. And because some of the ones in Antioch knew that they were going to take that too far and make her a goddess, they would only go so far as to say that Mary was the Christ-bearer, which is true. So there's two things actually going on at the same time. Well, again, Nestorius is from the Antiochian school. A guy named, so you know who I'm talking about, Cyril, is the bishop of Alexandria down here. So these two schools are fighting. Cyril is the guy down here. And Nestorius was accused of saying that the two natures of Christ was a moral union, and Cyril, because there are two things involved here, because he wanted Mary to be called the Mother of God, He is against Nestorius. And so in the end, Cyril gained favor of the Roman bishop, who is soon in history to become the Pope. And so he had Nestorius deposed. So you have the Bishop of Alexandria deposing the Bishop of Constantinople. And when Nestorius refused to yield, Cyril put 12 anathemas on him. 12, not 11, not 13, 12. 12 anathemas. He was damned 12 times over 12 things. Okay? So, Nestorius turns around and pronounces 12 counter-anathemas against Cyril. So this is a soap opera. This is two kids in the nursery throwing, Play-Doh at each other. So the third ecumenical council of Ephesus, 431, was called. They held the meeting at a church dedicated to Mary. And Cyril convened the council before Nestorius got there. He's still en route, and Cyril started the meeting without him and had him anathematized and excommunicated. The emperor, when Nestorius complained, overturned that ruling, and because Nestorius was mad, he called a counter council and counter anathematized and counter excommunicated Cyril. So the emperor had them both arrested. They both spend 2 years in prison, and finally they come to a compromise, and they decided that Christ, it was okay theologically for Christ to be dual in nature, but Mary was still the mother of God. And so in effect, Cyril accepted the compromise on the ground that Nestorius would be deposed and condemned. So, okay, we can compromise, but you're still damned. And in the end, the Antiochian party, Nestorius' party, just sacrificed him. Let him be the sacrificial lamb in the name of unity. And he died in exile in Egypt. So again, you don't have to know all that story. You just need to know that this is baby stuff. The real issue was Mariolatry. That was the cause of the mess, and they took political considerations in effect more than caring about what the Bible said, because neither of them were fully comprehending what the Bible said. So they were just arguing philosophy. Now, there's another little page to this, because you move down from Nestorianism to Eutychianism. Now, Eutyches is the guy that came up with that. And suffice to say, the followers of Cyril were not happy about the compromise made when they condemned Nestorius, because they wanted it entirely their way. Well, Eutyches is an Alexandrian monk down in Alexandria, Egypt. And he decided that Christ's nature was so godly that he was not a man at all. Christ was not even human. He was just thoroughly God, not human at all. And Eutyches was supported by, remember, Cyril, his successor, whose name was Diasurus. So they're going to try to rectify all this. So Diasurus calls another ecumenical council together. This is called the Robber Synod, S-Y-N-O-D. That's like a meeting of bishops. It's called the Robber Synod, robber like a thief, due to the scandalous proceedings that occurred. Eutyches was declared Orthodox, and his adversaries learned that they should keep their mouths shut, because at the Robber Synod, Diasurus rule the debates with the monks. He had armed guards on hand, and if they disagreed, he would beat them to death. He literally beat two of them to death if they disagreed with him. So it's called the Robber Synod. Brethren, we have met to worship and adore the Lord our God. Yeah, unity. And we'll end with this one. But so what followed then was the Ecumenical Council of Chalcedon, and they're still dealing with this thing. The first real pope, Pope Leo I of Rome, used the confusion to call this ecumenical council together, and he overturned the robber synod and recursed Eutyches. And in the end, what came out of the Council of Chalcedon was that Peter hath spoken through Leo, anathema to him who believes otherwise. So that settled it. He cursed anyone refusing to call Mary the Mother of God. And so this helped to establish, you know, Rome, the Pope in Rome, as the real Pope. So all that stuff's going on. Now, there's only one other thing I'd like to mention to you about all this, these long words. It's this here. Pelagianism and Augustinianism. Okay? We're used to arguing with Calvinists, right? And so Calvin took one side, and a guy named Arminius took the other side, right? Arminius was supposed to have believed that, you know, you can lose your salvation, that, you know, salvation is not of, that it's you earning it. And Augustine, of course, believed in the 5 points of Calvinism. Augustine was a Calvinist before there was a Calvin. Just so you know, in history, Augustine set forth all the major points of Calvinism before Calvin, well, long before Calvin was alive. Okay, well, what Arminius was to Calvin, Pelagius was to Augustine. Pelagianism revolved around human freedom and the ability to attain salvation. And basically, you could earn your salvation, okay, and then you risk the possibility of losing it after you had it because you have to keep working. Augustine, of course, it's all grace. It's the hyper-Calvinistic position of you were, damned or saved before the foundation of the world, and all the things, the tulip, you know, total depravity, unconditional election, perseverance of the saints, and all that kind of stuff. Well, Pelagius was on the side of, you know, you basically choose whether you're saved or not, and you work to earn it, and you can possibly lose it. Of course, Augustine was on the other side. I just wanted you to know that all played out and was argued about between Pelagius and Augustine long before John Calvin and Arminius ever showed up. So that would be something kind of important to remember if you could. And so then we step up to something else. We're going to get away from that. Because at this juncture, as you can see on the map, this marks the barbarian invasions. And after the barbarian invasion started in about 350 or 375 AD, the Roman Empire, I'm talking about the imperial political Roman Empire, fell in 476 AD, all right? Part of what happened there was this influx of barbarians, and we're not going to cover this just yet. Let me just talk about what happened here. In 476, the Roman Empire fell. It was taken over by a guy named, I'll put it here in the Mediterranean, Odoacer, the king of the Herulians. The Herulians were a barbaric Germanic tribe from up in here. And he came down and sacked Rome. in 476. Now, the rest of that we'll go over in a little bit later. But you need to know kind of why Rome fell. You can read long books about the fall of the Roman Empire, the rise and fall. Okay, well, one of the reasons that Rome fell was Constantine moved, when he became emperor, he moved the seat of government from Rome to Constantinople, way over here on Asia Minor. And because, you know, originally Rome was, you know, one of the oldest churches and so on and so forth, when Constantine moved it to Constantinople, there was a gap that developed between East and West. So I need to think about this. The Roman Empire, along this line, if you go up through the Med and then cut Greece off and then go up this way straight up, anything on this side of the line was considered West, Western Christianity. Everything on this side of the line was considered Eastern Christianity. So you have five major centers. You have Rome, Constantinople. This is one of the oldest churches and biggest churches. Some say 50 or 60,000 people were in the church in Rome at the time. And by this time, it's, of course, going downhill really bad. Constantinople, though, is the seat of government. So the guy that's the pastor here, the guy that's the pastor slash bishop here, the guy that's the pastor slash bishop in Antioch of Syria, where the Christians were first called Christians, right? Anybody that is the pastor slash bishop in Jerusalem, the city of our Lord, and anybody that's the pastor slash bishop of Alexandria, Egypt, these are all big cats. These are five big cats, all playing, all trying to get one up on each other, right? Okay, well, if you'll notice, if the line is drawn here, and it was, but roughly, east to west, then this left Rome isolated, while the other four, one, two, three, four, are on the eastern side and all argued with each other and fought over the spoils. And so, basically, with Rome being kind of left to herself, it kind of left her alone in some ways. And so the issues of the barbaric invasions, these folks came curling in, we'll talk more about them later, with taxes and the very fact that God will only put up with so much for so long. And so God destroyed the Roman Empire by a bunch of barbarians invading and destroying it. And by the way, he did it a few hundred years later when the Muslims invaded Christianity, what was called Christianity, because of their idolatry, heathenism, and basically blasphemy, right? I mean, these folks by that time are talking about infant baptism saving, about, you know, Mary being the mother of God and Mary being a goddess and all those things. And the Lord only puts up with so much. And so he destroyed the Roman Empire via the barbarians invading. And then a couple of hundred years later, he gives them another whack with the Muslims invading. Okay? And so when Rome fell, the Roman Empire fell, an opportunity opened up that nobody really foresaw, and that was the fact that now, rather than being a political, temporal empire, it left the right guy who had the right contacts and could make it work, the right political machinations, he could make it work. He had the opportunity to set up a religious empire. These guys over here are all fighting it out. This guy is left alone to consolidate his power. And so that's what happened in Rome. And like I said, you had those five cities basically battling it out. And Rome is a big, influential, prosperous city, well known throughout all of Europe. Constantine splits off the government from Rome, takes it to Constantinople, but by 440 AD, Leo the First, this is the first, what they call the first real pope, is claiming that Matthew 16, 17 through 19 is grounds for Rome being the seat of earthly authority over Christianity. Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I'll build my church, the Roman Catholic Church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Now that's not the right interpretation, you know that, but you will never convince a Catholic of that. Okay? And so by that time, Leo the First was openly propounding that. He was also pushing hard that there should be apostolic succession. We ought to be able to track, you know, our apostles, our leaders, back all the way to Peter, who was, of course, everybody knows the first pope in Rome, which is not true either. But it was taken as a fact. And so, like I said, there's this opportunity to turn this fallen imperial political empire into a religious empire, and the Pope was in the position to do it. The Pope had continued to gain power. If you recall, Irenaeus, a bad guy back in 120 or 30 AD, contended for the Catholicity of the church through a succession of bishops. And so he was all for it. You have a whole sequence of guys who made certain rulings from the Roman pulpit of the day. There wasn't a pope yet, but guys earlier than the pope, but these guys started making rulings that pushed toward the papacy. When Constantine moved the seat of power over to Constantinople, things split off, and that split between those four churches and this church, it was never they never got together again. And finally, and this is way ahead of ourselves right now, but in 1054 AD, there was an official split between East and West. And all the Eastern churches from this line over, Constantinople, Antioch, Jerusalem, Alexandria, they all went Eastern. And so on this side of the line, you're as likely to run into an Eastern Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, Greece on this side of the line, right? Greek Orthodox, Ukrainian Orthodox, up in here somewhere, Russian Orthodox, those are all Eastern Orthodox, whereas everything from this in this direction basically went Catholic. Not just Catholic, Roman Catholic. Okay? And so we'll have to get to the 1054 thing later. But that's how the papacy grew into the kind of character that it was. And so basically, you know, one pope after another, Innocent the First in 400 said, nothing in the whole Christian world should be decided without the cognizance of the Roman See. That is the Roman S-E-E, that's the Roman chair. And that especially in matters of faith, all bishops must turn to St. Peter, talking about Rome. Leo the First was the first real pope. He was the ablest occupant of the papal chair until Gregory the First. He was a royal jerk, but again, at the Council of Chalcedon, what was stated by the council in the end was, Peter has spoken through Leo, anathema to him who believes otherwise. So that's the beginning of somebody saying the Pope is when he speaks ex cathedra from the chair, is infallible, which is laughable in anybody's mind that has any sense. But they don't have any sense. They're religious pagans. It's not Bible at all. It's total tradition. It's total man-made religious nonsense. And so the papacy just continues to grow in power more and more and more. Now, we can get into a little bit of this, I guess, so that's cool. So what kind of kicked off the fall of the Roman Empire is the barbarian invasions. And I think this is kind of cool. I don't know if you like this, but I like it. About 325 to 350, basically the Roman Empire, if you drew a line roughly from here down through here, this was basically the Roman Empire. That was all the outskirts of the Roman Empire. They didn't control much above the Black Sea. So what started happening, first of all, you had the Huns and the Mongols. Those guys are coming in from Central Asia. We're talking here about Attila the Hun and others. They start pushing from out here in Central Asia over the top of the Caspian Sea. This is the Caspian Sea. And they start pushing westward. In the end, the Huns wound up doing a lot of damage, fighting a lot, and they ended up, this all gets into a rat's nest here, but the Huns wound up fighting all through here to the effect that many Germans today have a Hun genealogy. Now, with them pushing this way, that means that anybody that lives over here is getting pushed. So, before this, sometime before, most folks think that the Goths came from Sweden or Norway, the Scandinavian countries. So the Goths moved down into this area near the Black Sea. And some of them stayed over here. Some of them moved further northeast. When I say Ostrogoths, think Eastern Goths, because they're further east. When I say Visigoths, think Western Goths. You know, like Western, Germanic Western. So they come down, the Goths come down from Scandinavia, land in two places, with the Huns pushing from that direction. The Ostrogoths gradually shift and move to find new territory. They wound up landing, and I can't draw more lines where it gets really confusing, in like northern Italy. So that's still where many have Ostrogothic genealogies. The Visigoths, the Western Goths, they're getting pushed by both Huns and Ostrogoths, and their first move is to go down and sack Constantinople. Then they move on, and basically they just run a course along the seacoast, because they move down here into Greece, then back up north along the coast, then back down along the, you know, in Italy, along both coasts. They finally wind up, this takes, you know, scores of years, fight their way across, and this became known as the Visigothic Kingdom. We're talking about Spain and Portugal. So Spain and Portugal now have a lot of Visigothic blood. But this became the Visigothic Kingdom over here. Now, shifting. All these folks here, with not the Goths, but the Franks, the Angles, the Saxons, the Jutes, the Vandals, and there's not room for everybody. So the Lombards, the Burgundians, those guys were Teutonic or Germanic tribes. They all had their origins up here in northern Germany. And with being pushed from the east, the Jutes moved across into Great Britain. The Saxons moved across to Great Britain. The Angles moved across to Great Britain. So it's now called England. Angleland. That's where it comes from. So the Saxons and the Angles move across to Great Britain, and you know, they cross the channel and they settle over there. Other of the Teutonic Germanic tribes, the Franks, they got driven. They didn't move that far. they moved over into France. And so the Frankish kingdom is what spawned the French kingdom. So the French are Franks. The Vandals went on a longer journey. They're from up here, further east from these guys, but the Vandals are also Teutonic Germanic tribes. They get pushed. They move down through Spain, cross the Strait of Gibraltar, start whacking on North Africans, wind up at Carthage, kind of centering there from where they spread to Sardinia, and I believe this is Corsica, if I remember right. In the end, I think by the mid-400s, they too crossed the sea and sacked Rome. So these guys come all the way around to attack from the south. But so you have in North Africa, you have folks that are Vandals as far as their bloodlines are concerned, intermixed with other stuff. So that's kind of where some of that happened. The Picts, I'm not tall enough, they came from, we think, Ireland, moved down south into the British Isles. The Celts, of course, we know Celtic music. It's not the Boston Celtics or anything like that. But those are British Isle pagans that shifted a little bit. And that's what led, at least in part, to this invasion that caused the upheaval that wound up leading the Roman Empire to fall. We'll cover some more stuff next time. Any questions?